a grant from Pages for All Ages, Books, Music, Cafe, and DVDs, located at the corner of Route 45 South and Curtis Road in Savoy. Pages for All Ages offers a wide selection of books, compact discs, stationery, magazines, DVDs, children's books, and gift ideas, and features a full line of coffee, drinks, and teas at Pages Cafe. On the web at www.pagesforallages.com. Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and coffee bar.
It's 106, and this is WILL AM 580. I'm Tom Rogers. Jason Croft is our technical director, and at 1:30 this afternoon, we'll resume our coverage of the confirmation hearings of Judge Samuel Alito for the Supreme Court, taking place in the Senate Judiciary Committee all this week. And there is a chance that they may wrap up their proceedings yet today. In the meantime, before we resume our coverage, we have a bit of a changed schedule when we'll take a look at weather right now. And joining us in the weather office is our AM580 weather expert of the hour, Mike Sola. Good afternoon.
Thank you for that, Tom.
I just had a hard time figuring out what I was going to say.
Well, you're just happy that it's up to 54 degrees already.
Yeah, I should be outside.
Climbing a few more degrees. Yeah, we have to take a field trip this afternoon.
But it's not going to last, huh?
No, this is what you call spring fever, and it's the 24-hour bug-like spring fever, because by tomorrow at this time we should have rain and temperatures probably reaching their peak for tomorrow, and that will only be in the upper 30s. And then snow, northwest winds, and colder air pushing in. But again, that's not going to last very long either.
I was going to say, define snow in this case.
Well, there's a possibility that some central Illinois locations could pick up as much as an inch of snow. Northwestern Illinois, it'll be falling a little bit sooner, ending a little bit quicker. And the colder air will be in place up to the north and west of us. So they may have a couple of inches on the ground in a few locations northwest. But generally, not really looking for a lot of snow, and whatever falls, again, we have another warm-up on the way for Sunday with mild temperatures, so if it sticks, it's not going to last very long at all.
All right, let's get into the forecast.
Well, the forecast for this afternoon is beautiful. Mostly sunny, highs between 50 in northwestern Illinois, and that may have to be revised up because they've already reached 50 in northwestern Illinois. 65 the high in southern Illinois. Clouds will be on the increase tonight. Showers arriving in the south and in west central Illinois, with lows ranging from 32 in northwestern Illinois to 46 in southern Indiana. Windy tomorrow, turning colder, with western Illinois and northern Indiana looking at cloudy skies with some snow showers. Elsewhere, the precipitation will start out the morning as rain, changing over to snow, and highs tomorrow dropping back, not even to the average, but dropping back to 34 in far northwestern Illinois to around 50 degrees in the far south. Champaign-Urbana, mostly sunny this afternoon, breezy. The high temperature 57, the wind out of the south at 12 to 24 miles per hour. Increasing cloudiness tonight, light rain arriving after midnight, the low to 35. The wind southwesterly at 10 to 20 miles per hour. And again, tomorrow it'll be cloudy, windy, and turning colder. The rain showers changing over to snow. The high temperature 39 during the morning hours, then slowly falling temperatures with the wind becoming northwesterly at 15 to 25 miles per hour. Mostly cloudy tomorrow night, colder, the low 23 degrees, and then Saturday partly sunny, the high 38. In the extended forecast for Illinois and Indiana, northern and eastern Indiana mostly cloudy with snow showers and flurries possible. Elsewhere mostly sunny. Sunday partly to mostly sunny, windy, and milder. And then mostly cloudy on Monday with widespread rain showers. High temperatures Saturday from the 30s north and east to the 40s southwest. Highs Sunday and Monday ranging from the 30s in the far north to the 50s in the south and west. Low temperatures Saturday and Sunday mostly in the 20s, and lows Monday mostly in the 30s. Right now we have the temperatures spread between 50 degrees at Freeport and Savannah in northern Illinois, 51 degrees at Shelbyville, Indiana. Central Illinois cool spot is Mattoon, and they were at 53 degrees at the top of the hour. Warmest temperature, Metropolis at 61, Carbondale 60 degrees, Evansville, Indiana at 58, and central Illinois, Lacon 57 degrees, Danville, Peoria, and Decatur at 55. Willard Airport had 54 degrees with a dew point of 41. For a 61% relative humidity, the south wind sustained at 20, gusting to 28. The barometric pressure 29.71 and falling, and currently it is 54 on Friends Plaza.
All right. Thanks a lot, Mike.
Thank you, Tom.
That's AM 580's Mike Sola.
This weather forecast is made possible with support from the University of Illinois Employees Credit Union, a not-for-profit, member-owned organization. Their mission is to serve the complete financial needs of their members. University of Illinois Employee Credit Union information and services are available at www.uiecu.org or at 278-7700.
It's 1:11 on the Afternoon Magazine. Democratic Governor Rob Blagojevich says he has a way to pay for various construction projects throughout Illinois. The governor says he would use surplus money and a new lottery game to cover the cost. But Republicans are withholding their support. Sean Crawford explains.
The governor is traveling the state to promote his plan in front of enthusiastic crowds made up of local officials and those with a vested interest in the projects, such as construction workers. It might play well in front of the cameras, but the governor is yet to approach his toughest audience. Republicans in the Illinois legislature will make the final call. They've attacked Blagojevich for raising the state's debt, questionable awarding of contracts, and political gamesmanship. That stopped a construction package from winning approval during the governor's term. Sycamore Republican Senator Brad Brzezinski.
For some reason, we've been wearing the collar for that for 3 years anyway. I'm not that concerned about the political aspect of this, one way or the other. I think that if we can come to terms with those things, if the governor can and our caucus, great, let's move forward. If not, let's find something that we can do.
While Democrats control the legislature, it takes additional votes to borrow money, and at least a few Republicans will need to get on board for it to occur. Last spring, Democrats tried to ram through a plan near the end of the legislative session, but Republicans blocked it. Senate GOP leader Frank Watson says the governor's decision to take his message on the road rather than negotiate with the other party won't move things forward.
I'd just like to see a plan. I'd like to see something in writing. I'd like to see a bill. Bring us something that we can put our teeth into to know what you really want to do. No press releases, no shows. Let's just talk about it and let's work together. Let's communicate. We're not getting that. It's not happening.
Republicans complain Blagojevich is using the promise of projects as a way to paint Republicans in a corner, forcing them to vote for the plan or face campaign attacks that they held up money for a new road or school in their district. But politics cuts both ways, and Republicans have their own motives for holding out. They want to make sure Democrats share some of the windfall from borrowing a projected $3 billion. Senate Democrat Donnie Trotter says he understands the GOP position, but he says this would help the state.
There's a need. It's past due. It's been 3 years since we've had a capital budget. This seems like it may be doable, but it's certainly something that needs to be done at this time.
Blagojevich's plan would use what has been termed surplus money in the state's road fund, along with proceeds from a new video lottery game of Keno, to pay off what the state borrows. The game, which Blagojevich says he can authorize without legislative approval, would be earmarked for school construction. Geneseo Republican Senator Todd Seben says it's a bad idea.
Keno for kids? Is that what we're going to do now? We're going to have more gambling for kids for school construction? That doesn't make good sense.
Keno was brought up a few years ago by Quad Cities Representative Mike Boland. The Democrat wanted to use proceeds to help open a prison in his district, but the governor shot down the concept. Boland says he's glad to see Blagojevich has changed his mind on Keno.
It was kind of funny because he came to my area, of course, talking about the new capital budget that he wants. But anyway, you know, he said, well, we're going to fund the school construction through Keno. And it would have been nice if he'd have said, well, you know, Representative Boland here had that idea, and I didn't think it was good then, but now I think it's a good idea. But he didn't, unfortunately.
Despite the snub, Boland says he supports the governor's proposal. He says others will also, because an election is looming. No one wants to face voters empty-handed, whether they're Republican or Democrat. That can improve the chances of a construction program getting passed after years of failure. The lure of being able to dole out money around the state can change plenty of minds. I'm Sean Crawford.
Leaders in New Orleans have unveiled an $18 billion plan for rebuilding. It calls for new development, a light rail network, better schools, and investment in parks. The plan also creates a process to answer an explosive question: which neighborhoods will be rebuilt and which will not. Here's NPR's Greg Allen.
The fact is, after Hurricane Katrina, New Orleans is a much smaller city. Right now, the population is estimated at 144,000 people, down from nearly a half million pre-Katrina. Even after the city rebounds from the storm, it's expected to have just half of its former population. Yesterday, the 17-member Bring New Orleans Back Commission unveiled its plan for rebuilding the city to a restless, standing-room-only crowd at a downtown New Orleans hotel. New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin asked residents to take time to consider the proposals.
The realities are we will have limited resources to redevelop our city. The other reality is this report is controversial.
The most controversial part of the plan and any discussion of the city's future involves New Orleans' footprint. That is, which neighborhoods should be rebuilt and which should be turned into parkland or developed for other uses. The Bring New Orleans Back Commission largely sidestepped that issue for now. Instead, it sets up 13 districts where residents will work with planners to explore opportunities for rebuilding and work to determine how many people ultimately will come back. It's a daunting task, even more so in a city where residents are scattered across the country. Even so, planner John Beckman, who helped develop the blueprint, said it all needs to be done in just 4 months.
We need to begin the neighborhood planning process to involve the residents in making these decisions and determining how they will come back. And it needs to be coordinated in a citywide effort that needs to be completed by June of this year. This is fast, but it's doable.
During that four-month time period, the plan proposes a moratorium on rebuilding in any neighborhood that had at least 2 feet of flood water. That's some 80% of the city, and it's an idea that yesterday was clearly unpopular.
There's going to be an opportunity for public comment in just a moment, please.
I want you to tell me that. Don't tell me about what this public comment said.
Harvey Bender, a resident of the Lower Ninth Ward, was one of many who said he'd fight any plan that tried to stop him from rebuilding.
If we have to suit up like Army and to take my land, that's what I'm going to do. I don't need no police to protect me. If you try to come and take my land or whatever, that's what I'm going to have to do. Just like that lady said, I'm going to die on mine.
Commission members acknowledged that hundreds of building permits have already been issued and suggested the moratorium should be flexible, allowing exceptions wherever appropriate. Another part of the plan unveiled yesterday would create something called the Crescent City Redevelopment Commission, a body that would buy and sell homes and oversee the city's rebuilding. But still, a big question remains. Which neighborhoods will be rebuilt and which will residents have to leave? That's a question that ultimately will be up to the new Redevelopment Commission, a commission that will have the power of eminent domain and which could ultimately evict landowners if necessary. New Orleans developer Joe Cannizzaro, one of the plan's architects, says the four-month neighborhood planning process will hopefully make that unnecessary.
Can you get sufficient public service? Will you be able to get garbage collection as you customarily do, or zig it down to once every 2 weeks? So what we're trying to do is to bring the neighbors together and show them what's going on. Let them look at who's coming back, how many more of they together, and they'll understand.
Once Mayor Nagin signs off, the rebuilding plan will go first to Baton Rouge and then Washington, D.C. Although New Orleans has come up with an ambitious plan for its future, it will ultimately be up to the state and the federal government to decide where the money will come from. Greg Allen, NPR News, New Orleans.
This week in This American Life, Paul's a New York cop, and he pulled a double shift. So on his break on his second shift, at 3 in the morning, he got a great idea. He'd climb into the backseat of his police car, and he'd grab a nap, which worked perfectly, till he woke up.
I was like, oh, I'm trapped! That was my first thought. Because you don't get out of the back of a police car. The back of the police car is for prisoners.
Stories about things that seemed like a good idea at the time, this week.
Saturday at 1 and Sunday at 6 here on WILL Urbana.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday. It's the 12th of January, 2006. It's the birthday of writer Walter Mosley, born in the Watts section of Los Angeles, 1952. His first novel, Devil in a Blue Dress, published in 1990. Two more followed, A Red Death and White Butterfly, each set in Los Angeles in the 50s, featuring a black detective, Ezekiel Rollins. Mosley said he considers his mysteries character-driven, not plot-driven, and the character, of course, is the detective. Also the author of Walking the Dog and the science fiction novel Blue Light.
It's the birthday of poet and publisher A.D. Winans, born in San Francisco, 1936, who in 1971 founded Second Coming Press, which made a name for itself by publishing the poetry of Charles Bukowski and other beat writers. It's the birthday of writer John Griffith London, Jack London, born in San Francisco, 1876. By the age of 14, he was supporting his family by raiding oyster beds in San Francisco and selling the stolen oysters to market. As a teenager, he went to sea on a seal-hunting vessel, and in 1897 he set out for Alaska in search of gold. Instead of finding it, he found a whole range of experiences, which he then came back and crafted into stories. His first big success in 1903 with the publication of The Call of the Wild, followed by The Sea Wolf, White Fang, and his autobiographical novel, Martin Eden. Jack London, who wrote very fast, lived hard, spent most of the money he earned as quickly as he got it. He was the highest-paid writer in the United States and was proud of it, bought a ranch in California, built a huge mansion on his property, and late in his life he said, "I write for no other purpose than to add to the beauty that now belongs to me. I write a book for no other reason than to add 300 or 400 acres to my magnificent estate." Nonetheless, he considered himself a socialist. It's the birthday of the painter John Singer Sargent, born in Florence, Italy, 1856. He was the son of American expatriates, spent most of his life in Europe, in Paris, and in London, and created a sensation in 1884 when his portrait of a famous Parisian beauty, Madame X, was shown at the Paris Salon and shocked many people with its eroticism. He was the great portrait painter of Edwardian high society in England, but in 1910 gave up portrait painting and concentrated on murals and landscapes, including one for the Boston Public Library. And it's the birthday of the French writer Charles Perrault, born in Paris, 1628. He was a lawyer, he was a poet, he was a critic, and best known to us today as the man who collected the fairy tales under the title Tales of Mother Goose in 1697, including stories such as Little Red Riding Hood, Sleeping Beauty, and Cinderella. Here's a poem for today by Thomas Moore entitled Venetian Air. Row gently here, my gondolier, so softly wake the tide, that not an ear on earth may hear, but hers to whom we glide. Had heaven but tongues to speak, as well as starry eyes to see, oh, think what tales 'twould have to tell of wandering youths like me. Now rest thee here, my gondolier, hush, hush, for up I go, to climb yon light balcony's height, while thou keep'st watch below. Ah, did we take for heaven above but half such pains as we take day and night for woman's love, what angels we should be. A poem by Thomas Moore, Venetian Air. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, sponsor of American Life and Poetry, bringing poetry to newspaper readers across the country. You can find it online at AmericanLifeAndPoetry.org. Production assistance from Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 1:25 Central Time on WILL AM 580. In 5 minutes, we'll return to Washington for the Samuel Alito hearings, the afternoon session on this Thursday. In the meantime, let's take a look at the current trade on Wall Street and in the commodity markets. Let's go first of all with the stocks. The Dow is down 70 points at this moment at 10,974. The S&P down 6.5 points at 1,288, and the NASDAQ is currently not available right now. But we'll look at the crude oil price, which is up 46 cents a barrel at $64.40. The CRB index is down 21 at $335.50. The dollar index is at $89.51. That's up 52. Stocks were lower as investors took profits from a New Year's rally that sent the major indexes to multi-year highs. In addition, blue chips are coming under pressure from analysts' downgrades of two Dow components, Coca-Cola and J.P. Morgan Chase. Traders' concerns that economic growth will cause energy consumption to rise are sending oil futures prices higher. Mortgage interest rates are a bit lower this week. Freddie Mac says the average for 30-year fixed-rate mortgages fell to 6.15% from 6.21% last week. The 15-year fixed-rate mortgage, which is popular for refinancing, dropped to 5.76%, down from 5.78%. On the Board of Trade in Kansas City, May wheat is at 344 a bushel, now up 2.75. Just before the close in Chicago on the Board of Trade, March corn is at 213, up 1.5. The May at 222.5, down 1.5. Those are both down 1.5, actually. July corn at 230.25, down 2. December, 248.25, down 3/4. January beans down 13.5 cents, now at 561. The March at 573, down 11.5. And July beans at 591, down 12. On the Merck feeder cattle, settled at 112.87.5, up 82.5. Lean hogs for February settled at 59.77.5, down 90.
Good afternoon. This is Sue Martin with Ag Investment Services, located here in Webster City, Iowa, with our midday futures report. Well, the cattle market is getting a little bit of a reprieve today in all meats, actually. But I view that as just as a reprieve. It's like a dead cat bounce. We've not exceeded yesterday's lows, and we're just sitting here with an inside day so far. I would not be surprised that we still try to test the lows before the day is done. But we might do a meandering sideways for a couple of days, and then we start to tail off again next week. Yesterday's damage in the cattle market was big, and it sets up the tone for a market that should do, very possibly, a $10 break to $12 decline. So I view the rallies in markets in the cattle market as opportunity to sell. And hedgers, in my book, should be locking in profitability. The box beef appears to me like it's peaked out, and the movement hasn't been that great. In the meantime, we're looking at beautiful, ideal conditions in the feedlots, which is certainly helping the cattle to gain. And then you look at the fact that they're being fed the highest protein of feed that they've probably been fed in years. And so all of that allows for a tonnage to come on quite nicely. Feedlots are 95 to 100% full, barring the areas that where they have probably irrigated wheat. So when you look at the cattle and you look at the cow market, and it looks to me like cow slaughter is going to start to pick up as time goes on if we remain dry. And we look at the fact that beef production is going to increase probably 6% in the first quarter, 6 to 7% in the second quarter, and probably 4% in the third quarter. The market looks to me like it's dealing with its hands more full than its plates more full than it once was. I view the market as having topped for the first half of the year. This is Sue Martin with Ag Investments. Have a good day.
It's 129 on WILL, and our forecast for the rest of the afternoon from Mike Sola calls for sunshine, breezy conditions, unseasonably mild high temperatures of around 57 degrees. Right now it's 54 on Friends Plaza. And rather breezy south winds, 12 to 24 miles an hour. The clouds come in tonight. Light rain will arrive after midnight. The low temperature 35, southwest winds at 10 to 20. And for tomorrow, a change in the weather, cloudy, windy, and turning colder, with rain showers changing over to snow as temperatures will fall from a morning high of around 39, with northwest winds at 15 to 25 miles an hour. Again, 54, now 55 degrees on Friends Plaza. And in about 30 seconds, we'll go back to Washington for the resumption of the confirmation hearings on Judge Samuel Alito. Stay tuned.
This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan, along with NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg and David Savage, the Supreme Court reporter of the Los Angeles Times. Senator Specter, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, is back in the chair, and there's a panel of representatives of the American Bar Association testifying, ready to testify about Judge Samuel Alito. Let's listen in.
The witnesses, the tradition of the
the outside witnesses, the independent witnesses. The tradition is to hear first from the American Bar Association and their evaluation of the judicial nominee. We have structured this portion of our hearing differently from what had been done prior to last year, and that is where the majority took most of the outside witnesses. The tradition has been to have 30 witnesses, and the majority party had taken 18 and the minority party 12, and it seemed that it would be more appropriate to have an even split 15 and 15, and that is the practice we are following. And, of course, the ABA representatives are not witnesses called by either Democrats or Republicans. And to the, we have really done our best to proceed in a not non-political way in the selection of a Supreme Court justice. There can be different evaluations as to how successful we are in that, but that has been our effort. We have a limited testimony to 5 minutes for outside witnesses. The next witness already nods in agreement. He was here not too long ago for Chief Justice Roberts. And we have established the five-minute rule because we have 31 witnesses. And the Senate is not in session, and all the members of the committee have other commitments. And it is projected that we will finish today, but we'll have to keep on schedule. We turn now to the American Bar Association panel, and we welcome Mr. Steve Tober, Ms. Marna Tucker, and Mr. John Payton. In accordance with the practice, the testimony will be given by Mr. Tober, who is the chairman of the American Bar Association Standing Committee on the Federal Judiciary. He's an attorney with a law firm bearing his name, experienced in civil litigation, professional negligence, and domestic relations. Undergraduate in law degree from Syracuse University, on the board of the Law Review, deeply involved in New Hampshire and New England legal communities, former chairman of the committee to redraft New Hampshire's rule on professional conduct. We know the laborious job involved, Mr. Tober, which you are about to describe, in reaching an evaluation of a Supreme Court nominee and the importance of your judgment, so we thank you, and Mr. Payton and Ms. Tucker, for your public service. Now, Mr. Tober, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Stephen L. Tober of Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and it is my privilege to chair the American Bar Association Standing Committee on Federal Judiciary. I am indeed joined today by Marna Tucker, our D.C. Circuit Representative, and by John Payton, our Federal Circuit Representative. For well over 50 years, the ABA Standing Committee has provided a unique and comprehensive examination of the professional qualifications of candidates for the federal bench. It is composed of 15 distinguished lawyers who represent every judicial circuit in the United States and who annually volunteer hundreds of hours of public service. Our committee conducts a thorough, nonpartisan, non-ideological peer review using well-established standards that measure a nominee's integrity, professional competence, and judicial temperament. With respect to a nomination to the United States Supreme Court, the Standing Committee's investigation is based upon the premise that such a nominee must possess exceptional professional qualifications. The significance, range, and complexity of issues that will be confronted on that court demands no less. As such, our investigation of a Supreme Court nominee is more extensive and is procedurally different from others in two principal ways. First, all circuit members on the Standing Committee reach out to a wide range of individuals within their respective circuits who are most likely to have information regarding the nominee's professional qualifications. And second, reading groups of scholars and distinguished practitioners are formed to review the nominee's legal writings and advise the Standing Committee. The reading groups assist in evaluating the nominee's analytical skills, knowledge of the law, application of the facts to the law, and the ability to communicate effectively. In the case of Judge Alito, Circuit members combined to contact well over 2,000 individuals throughout this nation. Those contacts cut across virtually every demographic consideration, and it included judges, lawyers, and members of the general community. Thereafter, circuit members interviewed more than 300 people who knew, had worked with, or had substantial knowledge of the nominee. All interviews regarding the nominee were fully confidential to assure the most candid of assessments. Judge Alito has created a substantial written record over his years of public service. Our three reading groups worked collaboratively to read and evaluate nearly 350 of his published opinions, several dozen of his unpublished opinions, a number of his Supreme Court oral argument transcripts and corresponding briefs, and other articles and legal memos. The academic reading groups were composed of distinguished faculty from the Syracuse University College of Law and from the Georgetown University Law Center. The practitioners group was composed of nationally recognized lawyers intimately familiar with demands of appellate practice at the highest level. Finally, as we do in any standing committee investigation, a personal interview was conducted with this nominee. Judge Alito met with the three of us on December 12th, and he provided us a full opportunity to review matters with him in detail. After the comprehensive investigation was completed, the findings were assembled into a detailed, confidential report. Each member of the Standing Committee reviewed that final report thoroughly and individually evaluated that nominee using three rating categories: well-qualified, qualified, and not qualified. Needless to say, to merit an evaluation of well-qualified, the nominee must possess professional qualifications and achievements of the highest standing. During our investigation, questions were raised concerning the nominee's recusal practice and also concerning some aspects of his judicial temperament. We have carefully reviewed and resolved those questions to our satisfaction, as we have detailed in our accompanying correspondence to your committee, which, Mr. Chairman, we ask to be made part of this record.
Without objection, they will be made part of the record.
Thank you, sir. We are ultimately persuaded that Judge Alito has, throughout his 15 years on the federal bench, established a record of both proper judicial conduct and even-handed application in seeking to do what is fundamentally fair. As such, on the basis of its comprehensive investigation and with one recusal, the Standing Committee unanimously concluded that Judge Samuel A. Alito, Jr. is well qualified to serve as Associate Justice on the United States Supreme Court. His integrity, his professional competence, and his judicial temperament are indeed found to be of the highest standard. Mr. Chairman, let me say once again what we noted here back in September. The goal of the ABA Standing Committee has always been and remains, in concert with the goal of your committee, to assure a qualified and independent judiciary for the American people. And with that, thank you for the opportunity to present these remarks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tober, for your work and for ending right on the button, 5 minutes to a T.
I worked on that, Mr. Chairman.
Before, that quality of yours would recommend you for Supreme Court argument where Chief Justice Rehnquist stopped the speaker in mid-sentence. And the word from Judge Becker, who will testify later, he was looking for an opportunity. He stopped me in mid-sentence one day, and he's looking for an opportunity to stop the speaker in the middle of the word if. I didn't give him that chance. Before proceeding to questions, I want to yield to Senator Leahy to see if he has any opening comments that he wants to make.
I don't, Mr. Chairman. I don't. Thank you, though.
We have 5-minute rounds for each of the members of the committee, Mr. Tober. Picking up on your testimony that you found Judge Alito to have even-handed application of the law, how would you amplify that with respect to what kind of materials you looked at, what your evaluation was, and what led you to that conclusion?
I'd be happy to, Mr. Chairman. The conclusion was reached in large measure in interviews with, as I said, well over 300 individuals around this country, over 130 of whom were federal judges. Many were state judges. Many were colleagues, co-counsel, opposing counsel, who almost uniformly talked in terms of his even-handedness, of his open-mindedness, of his willingness to be fair. He's called a judge's judge more than once in those interviews. When we interviewed him, we had questions that would have been on that issue, and we discussed that issue with him to get his own personal perspective on it, and we were satisfied with what we heard at that time. And perhaps it's best reflected in his writings, which, again, I indicated the body of that work was read by our three reading groups collaboratively. And the conclusion that was reached, if you will, the overarching conclusion that was reached, is that this is a judge who brings pragmatic skills to his decision-making. We discussed that with him in that interview that we had on December 12th. He tries to do what he thinks is right with respect to the application of the law that's before him. He took us through how he analyzes that approach, up to the point that when he is just about ready to release his decision, he looks back once again at the law to make sure he hasn't misapprehended something in the first instance, and secondly, to make sure that the outcome is fair. That, to me, suggests...
So he came back to you twice?
I'm sorry?
Was your testimony that he came back to you? What did you mean when
he would look at his draft opinion, Mr. Chairman, before it would be issued, and he would look back at the law that he was applying in that opinion and the outcome that was occurring in that opinion just to justify in his mind one more time that the outcome would be fair.
Did your group study his all of his opinions?
The reading groups read 350 of his published opinions, scores of his unpublished opinions, and other materials, yes.
And did they make any analysis? An issue has been raised as to whether Judge Alito unduly favored the powerful or the government. Did your ABA analysis reach that issue?
That issue was one that we looked at, and we discussed it in our letter of evaluation. And I gave some examples of some of the disparate results that we were told about. One of the reading groups reported to us that they could not reach a full conclusion on whether or not there was some attempt to favor one outcome for a group of litigants over another. And while there were a couple of members in a couple other reading groups that may have said the same thing in so many words, there were a significant number of other individuals in the reading groups who said they couldn't find any such evidence of that. It was inconclusive with respect to the reading groups. What was of interest in the reading group reports to us was a comment that was echoed by others, which is that in looking for a sense of partiality in the opinions, the conclusion that was left very often was one of pragmatism.
Let me interrupt you because my time is almost up to ask you to clarify what was inconclusive in your studies.
It was inconclusive whether or not there were certain categories of parties who might have come out at the wrong end of Judge Alito's opinions.
Did some of those readers find that he was impartial and some find the contrary?
My understanding is it was inconclusive. We did not receive any clarion call at one point that he was representing or suggesting to have a bias against any particular group of litigants before him.
A considerable amount of attention has been paid in these hearings to the recusal issue of Vanguard. Would you comment on what your committee found there?
I'm going to defer to Mr. Payton, who took the lead on the Vanguard-related issues, if that's okay with the chairman.
Mr. Payton?
John Payton, a Federal Circuit representative of the ABA.
Recusal issues. We asked Judge Alito in some detail about how the Vanguard and the other recusal issues came about. But let me put this in some context, which I think will be helpful. In the materials that Judge Alito submitted to this committee, he attached a list of all of the cases from which he had been recused over his 15-year tenure. And that is 40 pages long, with about 30 to 35 cases per page. It's well over 1,000 cases from which he was recused. Among those cases that he was recused from were cases involving Vanguard in 1992, cases involving his sister's law firm throughout the tenure, cases involving the U.S. Attorney's Office throughout the tenure, cases involving the other entities that he had identified in his representation to this committee back in 1990. a few cases, in fact, slipped through, and that has been the subject of our inquiries and some of the testimony before this committee. We asked him how that came about. He explained how he thought it came about, but I think it's fair to say he was not certain how they slipped through, whether it was through the screen, whether it was because they were pro se cases. In the end, he did acknowledge that it was his responsibility, that a mistake, an error had been made. Those cases should have been caught, and he should have not heard those cases. We listened quite carefully to all of that, and in the context in which we understood how this came about, we accepted his explanation that he simply had made a mistake. These cases should not have slipped through the screen, just like the other 1,000 or so cases were captured by the screen in the process, but they did. They shouldn't have. We think that did not reflect in any significant degree on his integrity. Let me tell you something else we did that goes to both of your questions, Mr. Chairman. We also interviewed an incredibly broad array of judges, virtually all of the members of the Third Circuit, virtually all of the district judges that were in New Jersey and were in Philadelphia. We interviewed a number of the other judges in the Third Circuit who were on the district court who had contact with Judge Alito. What we learned from them almost unanimously was that he is held in incredibly high regard with respect to the issues that this committee, the ABA's committee, looks at: his integrity, his judicial competence, and his judicial temperament. And on the issue of the recusals, everyone thought that he has the highest integrity and that these few cases that slip through do not diminish his integrity.
Thank you, Mr. Payton. The red light went on during the course of your testimony, so I will terminate and yield to my colleague, Senator Leahy.
Patrick Leahy, Democrat of Vermont.
Just to follow up on that, the on Vanguard, the only reason I even mentioned this, when the initial explanations was from Judge Alito in the White House after his nomination, was a computer glitch had precipitated the Vanguard case. But then he answered some questions from Senator Feingold. I said in the Manga case it wasn't a computer glitch. On his failure to submit Vanguard to the clerk of the court. Then he said when it came before him, he was not focused. Since your report is filed, we've learned that, I was checking the dates here, we've learned that Judge Alito did not have Vanguard on his recusal list far back as 1993. I was saying the fact that in 1990 he had given a sworn statement to the committee that he would recuse. Some of that information came after your report. Would it change anything in the conclusion?
I think that it's, like I said, from the interview with him, I'm not sure we figured out what caused these cases to slip through. I'm not sure Judge Alito knew the precise answer to that. But he did acknowledge that it was a mistake. On what was on his standing recusal list, I don't know what was on his standing recusal list, but I just note in the materials that were submitted to this committee, there is a 1992 entry of an entity that has the name Vanguard in it. It's Vanguard that says recusal because on standing recusal list. I don't know what happened in 1993. I don't know if things went on and went off. Something went wrong here, and these cases came before him, and they shouldn't have, but they are a very small number in a huge universe of cases from which he was recused.
Senator, may I add to that very briefly? Sure. We did not find in the
Stephen Tober again
number of our interviews and the review with the nominee and any other extrinsic information we could look at any pattern of intentional effort to try and have Judge Alito impose himself in cases in which he did not belong. We are persuaded that some errors were made, some mistakes were made, and they total up to a small handful. In the course of the numbers that he's been sitting on. And I believe Senator Hatch suggested yesterday some 4,000 or 5,000 cases have been adjudicated involving Judge Alito. We took that into context, particularly in light of the comments from individuals who know him and work with him with respect to the ethics he brings to the position.
You understand the reason it became an issue here is because it was based on a sworn statement.
Yes.
They'd recuse. You also looked into his open-mindedness, his commitment to equal justice. I'm just asking, in doing that, because I've never served on one of these committees you're on, there's been a number of studies of the judge's record, the Knight Ritter, the Washington Post, Cass Sunstein, and others, and they have concluded he had a much more likelihood of siding against discrimination plaintiffs than other circuit judges. Knight Ritter reviewed 311 of his published opinions, found that he seldom sided with a criminal defendant, a foreign national facing deportation, employee alleging discrimination, or consumer suing big business. And his record stood out significantly from others in the circuit. Did this question come in on the issue of whether he was compassionate or?
The answer is yes. We looked at that. Our reading groups looked at it for us. We discussed it with the nominee in our interview on December 12th. We are not immune from the media stories that have been available. I suggest everybody on my committee has been watching the last 3 days very carefully. We are where we started with that issue, and that is the over 300 people we spoke with who know this person as a judge, as an individual, are convinced that he has an open mind, that he does not bring any bias to his decision-making.
And lastly, on the issue of CAP, nobody is suggesting a bias on his part, but what bothers me while you're doing a job application in 1985, I know Judge Alito is a very careful person, and I mean that as a compliment, and a carefully put together job application, he proudly proclaims his membership in CAP, a group that was very much dedicated to keeping minorities and women out of Princeton. One that would probably look unkindly toward either Judge Alito's Italian ancestors or my Italian ancestors. Why did this? Was this just pandering to the Meese and the Reagan administration, or is this just a total screw up?
May I defer to Ms. Tucker with that?
Sure.
This is Marna Tucker, D.C. Circuit Representative of the ABA.
Senator, we were very concerned about that listing, knowing that membership in that organization would put him perhaps on an extreme that we would be uncomfortable with. His answers to our committee were very similar, if not identical, to the answers to your committee. He did not recall when he became a member or even what he did, but he didn't recall ever attending any meetings or reading any publications. He did recall that he joined the organization because of the university's attempt to remove
ROTC. But that's not really my question. Was there any question why was he so proud of this that he would put it in 1985 when everybody knew what kind of an organization it was, where Senator Bill Frist had condemned it and Senator Bill Bradley had, going, you know, the extreme political polls, I suppose you might go. Did you ask why he proudly put that on his?
We asked him why he put that on there. We didn't ask him why he proudly put that on there. But he stated that he recalled he was a member. We specifically asked him if this was to, since it was a job application, that was he pandering? And he said it would be improper to not tell the truth on an application. that he was a member of that organization. But there were only two organizations that he listed, as I recall, on that application. One was the Federalist Society. The other was the Concerned Alumni for Princeton. He did not have a long list of activities at that time. But I should say, in fairness, we were very concerned about the membership of that and what happened. And all of the people we spoke to on the courts, women and minorities, people who he had worked with, people who had sat on panels with him side by side in issuing judicial opinions, almost universally said that they saw no bigotry, no prejudice. They thought he was a fair man. And they felt that if he did put that, they were shocked when they heard that that was listed on his application. And they said, that is not the Sam Alito we know. And we heard that time and time again.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tober. Thank you, Ms. Tucker. Thank you, Mr. Payton. Senator Hatch.
Orrin Hatch, Republican of Utah.
Thank you. Senator Kennedy.
Thank you very much.
Edward Kennedy, Democrat of Massachusetts.
You know, Mr. Tober, that the Vanguard Ventron, which is the case with 1992, actually involved the Carpenters, the names the Carpenters, which were on the Alito list for recusal. And
we weren't.
For the most of the, Mr. Payton, maybe this should be directed to you, and that most of the one people that have looked through there in detail feel that the reason that that was actually recused is because of the Carpenters. Or I think it's spelled Carpenters. Carpenter. And that was the reason. It was under the name of the Vanguard. You're familiar with that?
Yes. I simply thought that it was unclear whether or not what would have caused that to be kicked off because of the standing recusal list was any hit with Vanguard or something else. It's unclear. You cannot tell from what is there.
It, did the committee know when it inquired of the nominee that the Judge Alito had made a promise to the committee under oath that he was going to recuse himself from Vanguard?
Yes, and we asked him about that.
And did he indicate what was his response?
His response was that it was a mistake for those cases to have slipped through. That was not just a question about what the code said, but also what his representation to this committee encompassed, that it was a mistake.
And was the mistake, did you understand it, is because he didn't, for one reason or another, neglected to put the Vanguard on his recusal list?
No, I don't think I could say it that concretely. The mistake was that it got through. Why it got through, I think it was not completely clear to us. I'm not sure it was clear to Judge Alito. It got through.
Well, it wasn't on his 93, 94, 95, 96 list, and the 93 says no changes were made from 92. So, and he got on the bench. You'd only been on, so there's just 1 year, year and a half.
Don't